Well, thank you, Stefan, and thank you to everybody for inviting me. As Stefan indicated, it was about 40 years ago that I first came to Berlin, invited by another person named Dechen, Klaus Dechen, who became a close friend. And so I have a habit that whenever somebody by the name of Dechen asks me to come to Berlin, I say yes. So thank you to the wonderful Dechen family, to both of you, my great friend Klaus in particular. I could tell you stories. I knew Stefan when he was this tall, but I won't tell you those stories. It is a privilege to be here today and to try and address the question, did technology kill the truth? You know, we carry in our pockets today the greatest democratizing tool ever created. Never before has civilization possessed such an instrument of free expression. Yet that technology has also become a tool to undermine truth and trust. The glue that holds institutions and governments together has been thinned and weakened by the unrestrained capabilities of technology exploited for commercial gain. And the result has been the de-democratization of the internet. We have seen this gnaw at our political process. The agents that formerly curated fact-based debates have been cast off in favor of algorithms whose first loyalty is not veracity and the truth. We exist in a time when technological capabilities and economic incentives have combined to attack truth and to weaken trust. It is not an act of pre-planned perdition, but unchecked, it will have the same effect. Thus far, our response has been to address this 21st century challenge in 20th century terms and propose 19th century solutions. We need to do better. We must determine how to harness the new technology to protect against the very problems it created. I believe that such a technology-based solution is possible. And we'll talk about one idea that I think has particular promise. But first, we should begin with some perspective. Author Tom Standage has a gift for relating today's technology with its historical analogs. In Writing on the Wall, his book, Writing on the Wall, he traces social media back to Roman and even earlier times. Quote, in which information passes horizontally from one person to another along social networks rather than being delivered vertically from an impersonal central source distribution. Such horizontal distribution of information was a casualty of the fall of Rome. And for the next millennium, the Catholic Church, the landed nobility, and the landed nobility controlled the flow of information. Telling everybody what to think was a key part of keeping the princes and the priests in power. And it's no wonder that that era became known as the Dark Ages. But this vertical control structure held until Gutenberg, until here, in Mainz, Germany. Printing's relatively inexpensive distribution was the original information revolution. Its effect was once again to horizontalize the flow of information. Because the business of printing required something to publish, it helped stimulate thought and debate. Hypothesis and counter-arguments flourished, and the result fired the Reformation. It spread the Renaissance, and it set Europe aflame in war. We celebrate this departure from the Dark Ages, but it must have been a hellish time to live through. As people went from being told what to think to not knowing what to believe. You know, in 1545, almost 100 years after Gutenberg's breakthrough, Swiss scholar Conrad Gessler attempted to put his arms around all of the cacophony, the noise of conflicting information by cataloging all the books that had ever been published. And the preface to his collection eerily sounds like what we hear today. Because at that time, in the 16th century, a world awash in confusing information, enabled by a new technology, Gensler warned about, quote, the confusing and harmful abundance of books. The arrival of the telegraph, 400 years after Gutenberg, set off another round of concern about the abundance of information. In 1848, in order to share the costs of reporting from afar via telegraph, the major newspapers in New York City founded the Associated Press, the AP. At the same time that it expanded the flow of information, the AP also created a new concern over centralized control. During the Civil War, in fact, the AP became the Lincoln administration's de facto censor, dispatching only news that the government approved. There was also concern that the telegraph and the AP would spread fake news. A 1925 Harper's Magazine article entitled Fake News and the Public sounds like it could be written today. In warning about the power of the AP, the article observed, quote, once the news faker obtains access to the press wires, all the honest editors alive will not be able to repair the mischief he can do. An editor receiving a news item over the wire has no opportunity to test its authenticity as he would in the case of a local report. Sound familiar? As Stefan says, for the last 40 years, I have been fortunate to have participated in the development and expansion of new electronic networks that have bridged us from the telegraph to the internet. And in my timeline, everything starts on June 1st, 1980, with the launch of CNN. It seems so logical to us now. However, at the time, after decades of 15-minute and 30-minute nightly news programs on TV, we didn't know the words to describe what was happening. As president of the National Cable Television Association, I was the speaker at the launch of CNN, and I struggled searching for new words to discuss a new reality. I spoke of a, quote, telepublishing event marking a watershed in information provision. It was a bit over the top. But I was straining to describe how the multi-channel capacity of cable television could bring the diversity of the print newsstand to video. Mercifully, telepublishing did not stick. But immediately after the switch was thrown, I went to the CNN control room. What I saw was the opening salvo of the information world in which we find ourselves today. There on the monitor and going out to all the viewers of CNN was a live feed from a beach in Florida where nothing was happening. The correspondent was reporting that the anticipated hurricane had not yet hit. At that moment, the nature of news changed. Traditional TV would have waited for the hurricane to hit landfall. But with 24 hours of air to fill, CNN had just redefined news to include what wasn't happening. And while CNN opened the time aperture that had previously constrained video reporting, the basic paradigm of editorially curating what was news had not changed. Someone still decided what news was sent out. In Roman times, curation was collectivized as information moved through social pathways. Post Gutenberg, the book printer made the decision about what went out from his presses. The editor of the early newspapers made the same decision, often with a political bias. And we've already seen the concern about the editorial functions at the AP, which subsequently extended to newspapers, broadcast, and CNN. The abundance of video capacity on cable TV enabled the installation of multiple curators who differentiated their product through editorial decisions. CNN's founder, Ted Turner, had always worried about a competitor from the political right, since his audience skewed older and thus more conservative. His fear, of course, came true with Fox News. Telepublishing had indeed arrived, as opinion-based news created new titles on the video newsstand. The proliferation of cable news channels demonstrated how it was profitable to target opinionated programming to specific population segments. Today's social media news and information follows the same model. This time, however, the targeting is done with software-driven precision and a new kind of curation. The curatorial function of cable networks may have skewed left or right, but it still subjected its content to validation. In the social media world, there is also curation, but its standards are different. The software algorithms that decide our news feed are programmed to prioritize user attention over truth to optimize for engagement, which means optimizing for outrage, anger, and awe. It didn't start this way. Sir Tim Berners-Lee's World Wide Web was a uniform system for locating and retrieving information from diverse, curated databases. Web 2.0 came along early in the new millennium and turned the internet into a publishing tool for user-generated content. Suddenly, everyone had the reach, look, and feel of the New York Times or a major television network, and social media platforms became a key aggregator of that content. But the economic model driving social media was wildly different from traditional content aggregators. For a century and a half, the economic model for media companies was to assemble information in order to attract eyeballs for advertising. To maximize that reach, traditional outlets curated information for veracity and balance. In stark contrast, the curation of social media platforms is not for veracity, but for the velocity of advertising. Economic success on a social media platform is determined by how long it can hold the user's attention so that it can deliver ads. To accomplish this, the platforms accumulate information about each user and feed it to software algorithms that target the user with the content he or she likes. The famous statement on the front page of the New York Times, "All the news that's fit to print," highlights the difference with social media. The Times describes its purpose as deciphering the fit from the unfit. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, describes his company's purpose as building communities. Building communities is laudable until those communities become anti-community. Democratic institutions require social cohesion in order to function. I give Mark Zuckerberg and the other social media pioneers the benefit of the doubt. I suspect they were as caught off guard as the rest of us to discover how easily their platforms could be exploited for anti-democratic purposes. But now they know. It is algorithmic, directed content that creates the uncommunity that plays into the hands of those who profit from division. When delivering something that pleases a particular group trumps the delivery of truth, the stage is set for undemocratic exploitation. On average, Facebook users spend 50 minutes a day on the site, commanding the consumer's attention for 50 minutes a day through the delivery of compelling content. Sounds awfully like a media company to me. Yet Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg says, quote, "We're different from a media company. At our heart, we're a tech company. We hire engineers. We don't hire reporters. No one is a journalist. We don't cover the news," unquote. Those engineers, however, write algorithms that select among Facebook's posts to determine who sees what information. Like the mainstream media, Facebook aggregates content to sell advertising, only it does it with machines on a community targeting basis. Now, to their credit, Facebook has recognized their responsibility as an aggregator. After her "We're a tech company" statement, Ms. Sandberg explained, quote, "But that doesn't mean we don't have responsibility for what people put on our site," unquote. Such a recognition of accountability raises the question, just what are concerned social media companies, public policy makers, and citizens to do? The current focus on the impact of social media on the electoral process should serve as a stepping off point for a broader inquiry into the accountability of internet platforms and the oversight of that accountability. The U.S. Congress, as well as it should, is investigating Russian advertising purchases on social media and the use of the platforms as a propaganda tool. Thus far, the result has been to propose expanding to the internet the political advertising rules that apply to broadcasters and require the identification of an advertisement's sponsor. Looking to solutions established for the one-to-many era of 20th century broadcasting is insufficient for the targeted to the individual world of internet platforms. I was the U.S. regulator responsible for the enforcement of the political broadcast rules. they were inadequately transparent for broadcasting, and replicating them would be insufficient for the internet. The broader question is how to deal with the exploitation of the web as a vehicle for de-democratizing communities fueled by fact-free untruth. And I would argue that it was software algorithms that put us in this situation, and it is software algorithms that can get us out. It is time for algorithms to start playing both sides of the street. An algorithm is like a recipe describing how to combine various inputs to produce the desired output. For this cake, the eggs, the flour, and the milk are the digital information collected about individuals, the nature of the information being disseminated, and a description of the target audience. Today, the inputs to that recipe, as well as its outputs, are secret. My friend and Harvard colleague, Weil Gohin, has called for these inputs and outputs to be opened to the public through the common software practice of an open API. An API, an application programming interface, is what allows two software programs to interact with each other. An example of this is Google Maps. This algorithm-driven mapping software has open APIs so that other applications and their algorithms can work with it. An open API of Google Maps allows third-party access to its input and output. Uber, for instance, uses Google Maps open API to provide directions to the pickup point and destination. It's not Uber's mapping algorithm, but Google's open API that allows Uber to then build its own location-based algorithms that harness Google's location information for Uber's proprietary activities. Now, adoption of an open API by social media platforms would not open up the black box, the secrets of the algorithm itself, nor would it expose personally identifiable information about users. But by opening up what goes into and out of the algorithm, third-party programmers could create public interest algorithms to understand the effects of the social media distribution. For instance, understanding who purchased ads or created a post, and combining that with information about reach, engagement, and demographics would allow a public interest algorithm to assemble a picture of what is being spread and to which communities. As important as an understanding of what is happening is gaining that knowledge at computer speed. It takes only seconds for an ad or a posting to spread throughout the world. Yet to discover that the distribution has occurred can take hours or days. Being able to track what is going on, what is going in and coming out via a public interest algorithm would permit the kind of curation for veracity that platforms do not perform themselves. Truth has always required transparency. involving a new medium does not change that. Transparency about data on content, reach, engagement, demographic and geographic groupings would remove the mask behind which social media hides. Disclosing top trending stories and identifying viral reposting could flag what another Harvard colleague, Claire Wardle, has defined as the troika of untruths: misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation. And it would identify those untruths as soon as they get off the ground. And knowing what content is being deleted, how long it was up, and how widely it was disseminated before being deleted would help assess its impact, as well as encourage the platforms to act in a timely manner to enforce their posting policies. Let me be clear on two points. The open API would not reveal either the secret of the platform's algorithms or the personally identifiable information of users. We saw in our quick historical review how new information distribution technology has always created challenges for society. It is now our turn to step up to the challenges that technology has created for us. Our solutions must embrace the new technology and eschew the solutions of the past. The digital age reality of a powerful and distributed network of powerful and inexpensive computers must be put to work to attack the challenges that those forces have created. The internet platforms have delivered wonderful new capabilities. They have quickly grown to become the most valuable and powerful companies in the world. We should celebrate their creativity and their contributions. Yet their responsibility to the maintenance of democratic norms is something that has not been resolved. For the last 40 years, I've lived my professional life at the intersection of new technology and the public interest. I know how hard it is for policymakers to keep abreast of new technology and for new companies to accept that anyone other than they themselves might have a say over their activities. These are difficulties that are compounded by how dramatically different 21st century technology is from anything we have seen previously. In the 19th and 20th century, big government arose as an offset to the practices of big business. In the 21st century, businesses utilizing smart network software require similarly smart networked oversight. The technology that will define our future, software algorithms operating across ubiquitous network connectivity, must be harnessed to oversee the responsible operation of that technology. With a public interest API, the protection of democratic norms can be achieved without intrusive government micromanagement or bureaucracy. Open networks enabled the platform companies to flourish, having now become pseudo-networks themselves. It's time for the platforms to open up. Today, public interest groups of all political stripes monitor the mainstream media. With a public interest API, these same groups could also build public interest algorithms to accomplish the same result for social media. Social media platforms would be wise to provide such transparency voluntarily. But if they do not uniformly do so, then it will fall to government to require them to facilitate and require this openness. We began this discussion by asking whether technology will kill the truth. The answer is not if technology is allowed to respond in kind. It was technology that enabled a business model to prioritize advertising velocity over factual veracity. The same technology, however, can also be programmed to fight for truth and trust. All that is necessary is for the social media platforms to move from secrecy to transparency. Thank you very much.